We're now going to be speaking with Tim Good, who's live in London. I think he's in London. And Tim, if you don't know him, well, you should. He's conducted worldwide research on the UFO phenomenon for a lot of years. He's interviewed some key witnesses, dug up a lot of previously secret documentation. He's talked to astronauts and military officers and intelligence specialists, pilots, politicians, scientists. I remember when I first got involved in looking at the UFO phenomenon about 20 years ago, one of the first books I read was something called Above Top Secret, and it was just a masterful work, a compilation of all the key ingredients in the UFO cover-up story. In addition to his interest in UFOs and his many best-selling books, Tim is a violinist and played for, I guess, was educated at the Royal Academy of Music, played with the London Symphony Orchestra, also freelanced for such artists as Phil Collins, George Harrison, Elton John, Paul McCartney, Rod Stewart, and U2. Tim, you there?
I am indeed, George. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for joining us. You know, before we start talking about UFOs, maybe you should tell us, have you got any dirt on all those musicians, McCartney, Rod Stewart, U2?
No, I don't.
None you want to share. Okay. Right. I had a chance to, you know, Tim and I have known each other a long time, but I had a chance to see him in Denver at this year's MUFON Symposium where he spoke. We had a chance to chat afterward, and I'll tell you what, Tim, I was just blown away by your talk. And then I got your new book, Need to Know, and wow, is this a fair way to describe it? You re-examine a lot of really well-known cases and topics like Roswell and the DC overflights and things of those sort, but you fill in the blanks. I mean, you look at this stuff in a whole different way, with a whole bunch of new information. Is that an
absolutely
accurate description?
Exactly. That's a very good evaluation, George. Thanks. And by the way, you know, I was checking back on my interviews, and the last interview that I did with you was on 30th of March of 1990 on KLAS-TV, Las Vegas. Do you remember that?
I do. I do indeed. I still have the tape.
Oh, great.
Yeah, that goes back a ways.
Yeah.
You're dating me. So let's start this way in discussing your book and your new findings.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say there's a cover-up, I mean, that we've been lied to. I mean, I believe it. You believe it. Most of our audience believes it. Now what, though? I mean, how does it make a difference in our everyday lives once you reach that conclusion? And what do you do with it?
It's a very good question, George, and I've pondered about that over many years. One thing I have sort of come to the conclusion is that how many of us who are in favor of full disclosure seriously consider that those elements of the government, and they are few and far between, relatively speaking, in the United States government and elsewhere, who are in the know, do you seriously think we are going to get the whole picture if they do come out with what people assume might be the truth? I seriously doubt it. It's going to be spin. So I don't think that unadulterated disclosure is really going to do that much good, quite frankly.
Well, as if it would ever happen anyway.
Well, quite. But there will be, I'm quite sure. I mean, there's no way they can sit on all this stuff forever. So they've got to say something, maybe periodically, maybe, as Nick Pope has suggested, it'll come out through the SETI program. Hey, guys, you know, we've really discovered there are Earth-like planets, and, yeah, you know, we seem to have detected some communications between them, and, you know, there may well have been visits here already and that sort of thing, and sort of kind of casual.
Dribble it out a piece of it at a time, which is a lot of people believe that's the way it's going now.
Well, that's what I have been told by my sources, that gradual disclosure is the wisest agenda. And I might not have gone with that, you know, 20 years ago, but now I think probably that is the best way for the sake of all sorts of situations, you know, the economy. You can imagine the stock market. Just general sort of pandemonium. You know, hey, what are the, you know, hey, what are these guys doing here? You know, are they hostile, and so on and so forth. So I think it has. And the church, of course, is another thing. You know, the religious aspects of this subject must never be overlooked. I mean, the church is going to be profoundly affected by all this.
You know what happens when you know what happens. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Go ahead.
What happens when people like yourself or me express some reservations about anything short of total and absolute and immediate disclosure? Mm-hmm. People jump up and down and pound their chest and point at you. And, you know, I would imagine there are people listening to this program now who say, we deserve the truth. We need to know the truth. And, yeah. And nothing short of full and immediate disclosure is going to do. But, you know, as you and I have chatted privately, when you've been into stuff for a long time, you start thinking about it, and there would be repercussions, there would be consequences, and but you know that's a tough one for people to swallow. Some people who sort of have the religious fervor about UFOs, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the essence of your book, which is that we've essentially been involved in a secret war against UFOs, and it's not just a talking war, a shouting war. It's been a shooting war, and your new book, A Need to Know, documents many chilling and disturbing incidents that haven't been brought up before. So, Tim Good, stay right there. And ladies and gentlemen, you don't touch that dial. Come right back. This is George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. My guest is Timothy Good, author of Need to Know, UFOs, the Military and Intelligence, a stunning new book about UFO cover-ups around the world. Tim, I want to go over, you sort of rewrite the ufological history. I was particularly stunned by this document, this telegram that you dug up regarding Benito Mussolini. Tell me about that.
All right. Well, back in 1933, there was apparently the landing of an unknown craft on Italian soil. And this led to the establishment of probably the world's first top-secret UFO research outfit, and it was called Special Research Group Number 33, or RS-33. And it happened in June of 1933 when this unknown craft landed on Italian soil. And this agency was set up. Mussolini himself had a great interest in these events, being a pilot himself, especially when later on there were many sightings in Italy of these unknown flying objects, including one in 1936 when pilots were chasing these things and got fairly near, but of course they always dashed off as they do. But Marconi was one of the committee on this top secret panel, interestingly, the great engineer. Although, curiously, he didn't take that great an interest in the phenomenon, and he often, wasn't present at all the meetings. But definitely, I find that very, very interesting that there was a top-secret research group in Italy as early as 1933.
In your book, there's a copy of this this telegram, highly confidential Italian government telegram, on the personal order of Il Duce.
Yeah.
And what does it say?
Absolutely no mention is to be made of the alleged landing of an unknown aircraft on national soil. The same applies to today's news due for publication by the Stefani Agency and individual journalists. Maximum penalty for non-compliance will be enforced by the Tribunal for State Security.
You know, it makes me wonder is whether Mussolini had a chance to talk about this stuff with his ally Hitler in later years.
I've no idea, but it wouldn't surprise me at all. But interestingly, he made quite a prescient comment. He said, you know, that the Americans shouldn't worry too much about foreigners landing on their soil. But he commented that just before, this wasn't that long before February of 1942, when there were these extraordinary sightings over Los Angeles witnessed by well over a million people. You know, the five-hour air alarm, which I think you're all familiar with, during which 1,430 rounds of anti-aircraft shells were fired at these things in the sky with absolutely no effect whatsoever. But, and I think it's interesting that that Mussolini sort of was interested in this before it actually happened. You know, he thought there might be the chance of something like that happening.
Tell me this.
I've got the quote here, actually, George.
Sure.
This was a speech by Mussolini. Actually, it was a year. It was a year before February 1942. He said, "The United States are far more likely to be invaded not by soldiers of the Axis, but by the not-so-well-known but warlike inhabitants of the planet Mars who will come down out of space in their unimaginable flying fortresses." So, I mean, that's almost certainly the first official reference to possible alien spaceships. As I say, it was prescient in that a year later something like that happened. And it did lead, as you were mentioning before the break, to a conflict situation which continues to this day with some alien species, I am absolutely convinced.
Do you think the first signs of the conflict were in World War II with what we had known as Foo Fighters, although they never actually fired on American, they didn't fire on our planes, did they? Did they interfere with our planes then?
What I can say is that certainly there were, when we talk about Foo Fighters, people think in terms of sort of amorphous blobs of light that followed aircraft, particularly during bombing missions, and sometimes stalled the engines. They certainly did that with B-17 bombers and things like that, happened many on a number of occasions. But again, just before the end of the Second World War, there's an interesting story. Someone I spoke to, and it's come out for the first time in my book, a Free French Air Force pilot actually was sent up. This was at Selfridge Field, Mount Clemens, near Detroit, in July of 1945. And there were massive sightings of what the military thought were the Fugo balloons, some of which actually these were balloons launched from Japan, and they traveled right across the Pacific, and a few of them exploded, and most of them sort of crashed on the West Coast. I think no more than about three people were killed in total, and on one occasion. But a few of them actually did go as far, I'm told, as far as Michigan, and there was this extraordinary situation over Selfridge Field in the summer of 1945, when everybody saw these things, the public as well, outside this U.S. Army Air Force's base. And the commander of the base asked for a volunteer to go and shoot down the Japanese balloons, as they were assumed. So, believe it or not, a Free French Air Force pilot who was on detachment at the base as a P-47 Thunderbolt trainer, instructor rather, was sent. He went up, and he told me that he got us absolutely beyond the service ceiling of the plane, and he eventually got one of these balloons in his sights. And it looked like a sphere, but then he let rip with the eight machine guns in the wings of the Thunderbolt, and the thing suddenly flipped on edge, so that it looked like a disc on edge, and then shot off at phenomenal speed. And at that point, as he said to me, "This was no balloon." So this, interestingly, you know, I know that the French aren't the most popular with the United States government for not having participated in the Iraq business, but a Frenchman was the first, apparently, to attack a flying saucer over the territory of the United States of America. So I find that very ironical.
You think that there is a possibility that in that Los Angeles, that famous Los Angeles case, 1942, the whole country has war jitters. We're worried about the Japanese invading or flying over and bombing us, and so something was flying over Los Angeles. I think it was February 1942, and all hell broke loose, and we're firing off all these guns, shooting at things in the sky. Do you think it's possible that we shot something down then?
Well, something came down. That's for sure. And it was subsequently covered up from the next edition of one of the Los Angeles papers. Whether it was an American plane knocked down by friendly fire or what, we don't know. I would not be surprised if something was shot down. But what I do know is that from from that time onward, the American Army Air Forces renewed their resolve to try and get some of these, more of these things down. And they succeeded in 1947. What happened was that when the V-2 rockets, which were being launched from White Sands Proving Grounds, New Mexico, with Werner von Braun and his team of captured German scientists, of course, and they brought the rockets over. The Russians got some as well, but the Americans got the best team of scientists. And, of course, they were developing the V-2s for the American space program. And in May of 1947, when one of the very first V-2s was sent up, a strange disc was seen sort of zooming round this V-2, and this has been confirmed by the actual director, the commanding officer of White Sands at that time, that strange phenomena were responsible for bringing down ahead of its normal the area where it was supposed to actually come down, a V-2 rocket. And this was on 15th of May. Peculiar phenomena were blamed for the unexplained premature flight of the V-2. And this led to a renewed resolve to try and bring more of these things down. And they did succeed. And it started May, June, continuing on into July and further on. What happened is we started firing at these things, and I believe several were brought down, leading to the so-called Roswell incident. There might well have been additional things. There was more than one craft involved, and they were seen over a period of days. And I've reproduced newspaper articles from the period, thanks to a great guy, John Andy Kistner, a former state representative for Las Cruces, who was in the aerospace business, who's given me a great deal of help with this aspect of my book, and I wouldn't have been able to do it were it not for his fantastic research over many years. And he's dug up tons of stuff. And what happened when the United States Army Air Forces, as they were known prior to September of 1947, began firing at these things? We brought some of these craft down. And the ones that were involved in the so-called Roswell incident took several days, actually, to come down. They were actually seen wobbling around the sky for some period. And there were many reports by people. And this led to an unprecedented wave of attacks on our aircraft. And I'm not just talking about United States. Worldwide, there was a wave of aircraft disasters involving military planes, not just those that had been sent up to intercept, but just ordinary aircraft as well, including airliners, many of which could not get off the ground. They could not unstick, as they say in the aviation trade. And the official explanations were that these aircraft were simply running out of fuel. Well, you know, you don't get that many planes running out of fuel after they've just taken off. And this was worldwide, hundreds. And I've cited probably about, I don't know how many, maybe 50, 60, something like that, but there were hundreds all over the world, and Truman ordered an inquiry. The government was panicking about this situation, and I'm convinced that's because it was retaliation by some of the UFOs for the fact that we'd shot down some of their discs.
Yeah, it's a very disturbing account when you look at all of these newspaper clippings, one right after another.
Yeah.
At this time period, round the world series of plane wrecks kills 180 in the Las Cruces Sun, New Mexico, and then a follow-up in the New York Times. We'll talk about those when we come back from our break with Tim Good, author of Need to Know. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. We're speaking tonight with Tim Good, live from London. He's the author of Need to Know, UFOs, the Military, and Intelligence. He's written a lot of international bestsellers about UFOs and cover-ups, but boy, this is a blockbuster. I'm looking at a couple of the clippings that are included in his book, including this, an article by the Associated Press, June 1st, 1947, talking about round-the-world series of plane wrecks kills 180. And then a couple days later, another article from the New York Times in which President Truman expresses his deep concern about this unprecedented wave of military and civilian air disasters around the world. He called for a nationwide intense study to see what was going on. Tim Good, the author of this book, believes that we were in essence involved in a shooting war, a secret shooting war against the ETs or the alien visitors. And when we come back in just a moment, we're going to ask him about how to prove this. So stick around. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. We're joined by Tim Good, author of Need to Know. Tim, you essentially believe there was a shooting war, and you look at these headlines about all these crashes, and it's before, during, and after the Roswell thing. So essentially, you're saying Roswell was one incident of many.
Well, I don't know how many recoveries there were, George, but I certainly think there were some during the First World War, which I've mentioned before. In fact, I've mentioned in previous books, and I've added a few more. There was certainly one in that came down in New Mexico in August, in the late summer of 1945, which I've discussed briefly. Came down in a little town of San Antonito, near San Antonio, New Mexico. And this was taken away by the army. And there have been other instances, one in Ohio in 1944. Whether these were shot down or not, I do not know. But Roswell was not the first. But you're talking about the evidence. How can we prove this? Well, I think the proof is contained in many of the newspaper articles of that period, the contemporary news articles, from local papers to the New York Times. I mean, this was worldwide. There was a situation that pilots were reporting discs in the sky. There were accidents happening all the time around that period, many of them completely unexplained. And incidentally, later on, we might come to this, but the official U.S. Defense Department accident statistics, which I've got thanks to Richard Hall, Richard H. Hall, the great investigator, who was given them by Dr. Olavo Fontes. There were something like, off the top of my head, I can't remember exactly, but from 1952 to October of 1956, there were about 1,700 unexplained accidents involving interceptor aircraft of the type that would be used to intercept, chase UFOs, just from that period. So if we were to look at the records, the way to prove it would be to look at the military records of these many, many accidents, and I think it would be very, very interesting indeed if we can get all those.
Let's focus on Roswell for a couple of minutes. You write in your book, and from the outset, Roswell has also been the subject of an intensive counterintelligence campaign using every conceivable trick or tradecraft by fair means or foul, such as threatening and discrediting witnesses and fabricating counter evidence.
That's right.
That's pretty tough to cut through it, because these guys who do this stuff are good at it, aren't they?
Well, of course, it's their profession. You know, counterintelligence, for example, the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, AFOSI, has been involved for many, many years. And there are thousands of people involved in counterintelligence deception programs to put out false information and discrediting witnesses and so on. It still goes on, and it can be very, very effective indeed. Also, you have the media can be influenced by people in counterintelligence. It's called perception management. We call it news management over here. It's rather sort of devious method of doing things, but it is done. If spin is another word, just altering a few facts, discrediting witnesses. It's quite easy, and it's very, very effective.
You know what's amazing to me? You've dug up all these newspaper articles that have just never been mentioned in this context before, that sure seemed to paint a pattern right before Roswell that things were going on in the sky that could have been related to this crash. I mean, you know, one of the things you mention in the book is this discrepancy about when Mac Brazel actually reported finding the wreckage that we know today as the Roswell incident. Now, what's the significance of that?
Well, I don't know exactly, George, quite frankly, without going through all the you know, the facts and figures and everything. But what I do know is that in around the 26th, 27th, 28th of June, in New Mexico, a number of these disks were seen wobbling around the skies. They were described as sailing or falling objects. And, for example, there's the El Paso Times of 28th of June, which I've got in front of me here, and it talks about conjecture as to whether the falling objects had any relation to the mysterious flying disks which had been variously reported. And in fact, there was a search parties were sent from White Sands in attempts to locate the objects or to secure additional information. And of course, they eventually got them. But maybe the rancher was the first to report one of the sites. I think probably that's what may have happened. There were several sites. There's still some doubt about the exact location of the sites. There might have, some people say there were two, some people say there were even three. There's still some confusion about that, but a lot more information is coming out now. And of course, we have Walter Hout, who apparently signed a sort of like what amounts to a deathbed confession that he himself, he was the press officer for the United States Army Air Forces at Roswell Army Airfield at the time. And, you know, finally, after his death, we learned that he'd actually had a glimpse of the alien beings themselves recovered in one of these incidents. So, you know, the truth is sort of gradually emerging. Over the years, more and more people are coming forward, and I've introduced several more witnesses, people like the Polish biophysicist, who together with a small team of scientists, of biophysicists from Britain, from France and Italy, and this was a Polish guy, were actually shown at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory back in April of 1977, the JPL at Pasadena. They were taken down to a vault three levels below ground and shown in this top secret area remains of some of the alien beings found in New Mexico. No specifics were given, but this biophysicist describes in great detail his opinion that this was not the skeletal structure that he examined was neither that of a chimpanzee nor a small child, but there was also a large part of the skull that were exhibited in this top secret room, and I find that testimony very, very compelling indeed.
I remember your presentation in Denver that you mentioned this, and I found it fascinating. I think you used a pseudonym for this Polish scientist. Do you know his real name?
Dr. Chris. Dr. No, Chris. I don't, but I know who does.
And is he still alive?
One day I'll get to meet him, I'm sure.
You think he is still alive then?
Oh, yes.
Another, you know, something that sort of separates you from a lot of the UFO researchers is your access to really high-level military folks, both in Britain there and in the United States. And one of those who helped sort of put things in perspective about Roswell for you is someone I've also spoken to over the years. His name is Brigadier General Arthur Exon. Tell me what light he was able to shed on the Roswell mystery.
I have to say, George, I never met General Exon.
So I cite
his testimony. It was Schmidt and Randall who were the first to come out with a lot of his information, I believe, and they published that in one of their first books on Roswell.
How does it relate to what you've written in this book about Roswell?
I think some of it relates very much so. I find his testimony very compelling, but often these guys might sort of provide provide diversionary information, shall we say, just to protect themselves or to protect some other people or anything. So it's you know, when military people come up with information, it often is accompanied with disinformation, particularly when you come to exact areas where things were recovered and things like that. I mean, they don't want people going out to these places and sort of combing them, because there's more, definitely more than one crash site involved in the Roswell thing, and there's quite a bit of new testimony that's been provided. But as I say, that was just one. Werner von Braun apparently was also shown some of the recovered bodies, according to Clark McClelland, who was a NASA aerospace engineer. And he kindly provided me with some information, and he chatted to von Braun about Roswell, and he allegedly said, I'm quoting Clark here, he says that he and certain of his associates have been taken to the crash site after most of the military were pulled back. He told me the craft did not appear to be made of metal as we know metal on Earth. It almost seemed to be created from something biological. And the bodies, he said, were temporarily being kept in a nearby medical tent, small, very frail, and had large heads and large eyes. And he said that his inspection of the debris had even him puzzled. Very thin, aluminum-colored, like silvery chewing gum wrappers, very light and extremely strong. Well, we've heard that before from other people, of course. And he says that the interior of the craft was nearly bare of equipment, as if the creatures and craft were part of a single unit. So that's someone else. And also there's a number of other witnesses who are cited, like Sergeant Robbins, which I've gone into in some detail. I don't know how many. We don't need to go into the whole story here. But
tell me this, Tim. You mentioned that, you know, the shooting war had been going on before Roswell, during, and
yes,
after.
Yes.
You mentioned a couple of minutes ago these figures compiled by Richard Hall about unusual...
By the United States Defense Department. Yes, there were. I can get hold of these statistics in a minute.
But, I mean, the question is how long...
I have them here, yeah.
Sure. How long did this shooting war go on? And these numbers indicated that you mentioned earlier that it was from 52 to 56. So
I think it continues to this day. I think there is a conflict with some of these beings. Of that, I'm absolutely certain.
I mean, do you have recent evidence, recent suggestions or testimony that we're still shooting at each other?
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, there's all sorts of reports of people, you know, letting loose with like, Sidewinder missiles at these things. It continues. But I would say generally, for example, in 1998, I think it was in China, Chinese Air Force plane was sent up to intercept a UFO, and he got the thing in his sights, and he requested permission to fire at it, but ground control forbade him to fire at it. So I think probably there's a lot of common sense involved in situations, especially when one realizes that there have been these awful accidents.
Tell the audience who Lord Hill Norton is and what he's told you.
He was an admiral of the fleet. He was former chief of the defense staff of the United States government, and he was also chairman of the NATO Military Committee. He died a few years ago. But he was enormously interested in the subject. He helped me a great deal over the years. He himself had not, and I do believe him on this, had not been exposed to any great secrets about the subject at all. He did all he could after he retired to find out, and he did discover some things. But it's interesting that someone in a very high position like that, you know, former chief of defense staff, had no exposure, as they say, in the military to the subject, officially at any rate.
Ever any discussion with him or other British military officials about the possibility of, and I don't know the answer to this, I'm just asking off the cuff, but whether or not there is a British Roswell? This question was sent in by one of the listeners the program a few days ago, but is there any indication that the British military forces tried to shoot him down and may have succeeded?
I wouldn't doubt it. I have no firm information myself about that. There are various rumors of incidents, but I have no solid information, you know, to sort of base any opinion on at the moment about that. But what I do know is I'm quite sure there has been a conflict situation, and that it has been covered up. I'm absolutely certain that many British military aircraft have disappeared, pilots never found, aircraft never found, that sort of thing, just as they have in the United States and other countries. Now, I've got these statistics in front of me from the book. There were, from 1952 until the end of October 56, 18,000 1,662 major accidents of military aircraft, most of those involving high-performance interceptors of the type that would be used to chase the flying discs. Now, that's an extraordinary number of major accidents. And of that total, 56% were found to be caused by pilot error, 8% by ground crew or other personnel failure, 23% failure of parts and equipment, and the actual figure of unexplained accidents is 9.5, which amounts to 1,773 accidents due to unknown factors. Now, wouldn't it be interesting to research all those cases involving unknown factors? Perhaps someone should file a Freedom of Information request about that.
Consider it done. We'll get on that. Tell me, what about the ghost rockets? Before we leave this period, after World War II, this phenomenon is known as ghost rockets, and over Scandinavian countries, and a lot of folks thought they were just regular missiles. What's your new take on that that you express in the book?
Well, first of all, my book has a foreword by Bill Gunston, who is one of the world's foremost aviation historians, and he absolutely assures me that whatever the ghost rockets were, they were not Russian rockets using captured German equipment. That was the prevailing theory of the intelligence people and the military at that time. Often, rockets need guiding vanes. You need some kind of thing to direct them. These missiles that were seen frequently had absolutely no fins or vanes or anything like that. And they often moved just completely different from the way rockets move. They were sometimes, seen sort of diving and climbing, other times proceeding in a relatively leisurely sort of manner. And there were actually accidents. I mean, this was going on not just in Scandinavia, though particularly in Scandinavia, but it was around the world, actually. There were reports from India, Turkey, many other countries, Greece. And the incidents of there were a number of aircraft accidents, as a matter of fact, quite disturbing. And I've reproduced a headline from the I believe it's the New York Times here. Ghost rockets, plane hits rocket, three Swedes killed. And so you see, there were a number of disturbing incidents then, and that some of these things were seen diving into lakes as well. We don't know what was going on there at all. And as I say, the consensus at first was that these were Russian rockets, but they were not. They were, and they obviously weren't ordinary rockets of any kind.
One of the incidents that really caught my eye in the book is it's August 1947. This B-25 Mitchell twin-engine bomber crashed near Kelso, Washington, killing the pilots, Captain William Davidson and Lieutenant Frank Brown. They were intelligence officers.
Yeah.
And I guess apparently they were returning from Tacoma, Washington, where they'd interviewed, of all people, Kenneth Arnold.
And Captain Ed Smith, that's right, who'd both been witnesses to UFO sightings earlier that summer. And this became known as what I refer to as the sinister Maury Island incident of 21st of June, which is a very strange episode. And there is a very good book by Ken Thomas. It's called Maury Island UFO, The Chrisman Conspiracy by Ken Thomas, published by Illuminet Press, and I find that absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, the Chrisman name pops up in some interesting places. When we come back, we'll look a little bit more into this incident, as well as the infamous Washington, D.C. overflights and some new information there. Stick around, everyone. We're talking with Tim Good, author of Need to Know. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, welcome back, everyone. I'm George Knapp, your host for Coast to Coast tonight. We're talking with Tim Good, the British author of Need to Know and many other UFO bestsellers, about a secret war against the aliens. He believes that there's substantial evidence that we've been in a shooting war against whoever is flying these UFOs around, and they've been shooting at us, and we've been shooting at them. you know, Tim, we'll get back to some specifics. I guess what I'd be wondering is, you know, given the fact that that from everything we know about UFOs, wherever they're from, other planets or dimensions or whatever, that they're so far technically advanced, so far beyond what we have, why haven't they just wiped us out? If we're shooting at them, they're shooting at us, you'd presume they could do a lot more damage than they've done.
Absolutely. I agree with you. And this makes me very skeptical about the whole possibility. But at the same time, there have been incidents where we have shot at these craft and in some cases have brought them down, certainly in the early days. My understanding is that even our technology has been developed to the extent that we now have very, very capable weaponry to deal with some craft, but I'm quite sure that they could wipe us out if they wanted to, no question about it.
Well, you know, maybe then you get into stories like about Area 51 and Bob Lazar and Phil Corso and things like that, that we've been able to recover this technology. Maybe we've lessened the gap over the years.
Exactly. That's absolutely. I'm with you 100% on that one, George. No question.
I want to go back to this incident with these two military pilots. This is incredible to me. They fly up to interview Kenneth Arnold, the guy who started the modern UFO era. He saw these nine flying discs, I think it was, over our saucer-like objects in over Washington State. You know, the first big story of the modern UFO era. The military pilots who go up to interview him, flying back, and they crash and die?
Yep. Well, there's this mysterious guy called Fred Chrisman, who was a mysterious character, definitely with a background in counterintelligence, which included U.S. Air Force and the CIA, including black operations for the CIA, who had investigated and, in my opinion, contaminated the case. And he is the one, Chrisman, came in, he intervened, and there was Kenneth Arnold and Captain Smith when they were being interviewed by these Air Force intelligence officers. Chrisman gave the officers a box containing, you know, huge chunks of the recovered fragments of this sort of metal-like stuff, which was seen falling from the sky from six flying objects which were seen above Puget Sound in Washington. I mean, I won't go into all the case here, but it happened in Maury Island, and there were many witnesses on a boat, and definitely stuff was coming down out of the sky from one of these craft which appeared to be in trouble. And the materials were loaded onto this B-25 at McCord Field, Army Airfield, and there's some evidence. Kenneth Arnold says that the materials looked rather different from the aluminum-type metals that he and Ed Smith had been shown previously by Chrisman. So I think probably Chrisman switched some of those samples. Whatever the case, the plane crashed. It caught fire. Officially, just one of the engines caught fire. But the emergency firefighting system failed to work. The pilots never followed. Some of the crew members ordered some of the passengers to bail out, but the pilots never followed. The pilots did not notify anyone signifying the problem, and it's not known why they didn't parachute out as well. So it's a very mysterious case, definitely. And interestingly, Chrisman crops up in a number of incidents involving counterintelligence and UFOs, and he was allegedly one of the three tramps arrested. You remember in the Kennedy assassination, there was a photograph of these so-called tramps, and Fred Chrisman was one of those people. So that I find that very interesting.
Well, that just blows me away. I mean, I can't believe that I've never read that before until I saw it in your book here, that Chrisman could have been one of those guys and has been involved in UFO counterintelligence all these years. That's pretty weird.
Yeah.
Let's talk about for a minute about the D.C. overflights. In July 1952, it's one of the most famous UFO episodes ever. Series of UFOs seen over Washington, sensitive areas, over the Capitol. Military jets are scrambled. They go after these things. They can't catch them. That's the official story becomes, oh, the radar operators who saw these things, it was just caused by a temperature inversion.
That's right.
Give me your take on that story and tell the audience the kinds of new information that you've acquired for this book that puts it in a different light.
Well, just, you know, to take one example, the sort of general impression one gets is that these were just blobs in the sky and they sometimes showed on radar and other times not. But in fact, sometimes quite large objects were seen quite clearly, such as there was one object about 100 feet long which hung in the air, cigar-shaped craft. This was leading up to Washington, the D.C. sightings. And then at one stage, shortly after objects were seen heading towards D.C., over 500 people on the ground observed this strange object hovering north-northwest of the city, including a physics professor from George Washington University, who says that during the 8 minutes this object was in sight, it came down so low that downtown buildings were obscured from his view. So that I find an interesting aspect of the D.C. sightings, that one actually came down that low.
You talked about these giant craft. I think I can't remember where it is exactly in the book, but I thought it was in relation to the Washington D.C. Overflights, where these things like the giant craft from Independence Day or something were way up in the sky.
That's absolutely right. This is according to Major Donald Kehoe, who was a hero of mine, and he was responsible indirectly for stimulating my interest in the subject back in 1955. He discovered that during the period UFOs were being tracked in the D.C. area, gigantic objects were tracked orbiting Earth. Two of them, he says, came down between Washington and Baltimore and hovered at around 79,000 feet. And this is what he told journalist Bob Pratt, whom I knew as a very, very good journalist. This is what Kehoe says. I talked with one of the pilots who was in the jet squadron that was trying to get up near one of those things, and he said, "I've never been more terrified in my life. Just to look at that thing, you could tell that you'd be crazy to go up there and try and shoot at it. Thank God we couldn't get up that close." Later on, he had a friend who told me, "Yeah, I was there, and I was scared too. I don't know any of the pilots that were involved who weren't scared just seeing those huge damn things." Like that.
But it is sort of like the imagery from Independence Day, those gigantic mile-long ships, and the smaller ones would, yeah. Okay, Tim, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the comments from pilots about the D.C. overflights, what they weren't told and when they were sent up to go against these things. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Coast AM, everyone. I'm George Knapp. I jumped the gun there a little bit. We're talking with Tim Good. And the author of a book called Need to Know about military encounters with UFOs. And Tim, we were talking about the July 1952 overflights of Washington, when a lot of American warplanes were sent up to pursue these UFOs, these objects. In your book, you mentioned that the pilots there are some comments from pilots who are very upset that they weren't told the truth about what they were going up there to chase, right?
Yep.
Would you elaborate on what it was, what their concerns were? I mean, were they close enough to see these things to be concerned about what it was that they're going up against?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I'm quite sure that footage was taken with gun cameras at that time, but the whole thing had to be downplayed. There's absolutely no question about this, and so the pilots were very unhappy that a lot of their reports were being publicly discredited when they knew that all these things were going on. And we know that General Benjamin Chidlaw, who was former commanding general of what was then called Air Defense Command, said in 1953 that we take this stuff seriously when you consider we have lost many men and planes trying to intercept them. And this, of course, is one of the big secrets. And it was confirmed. I mentioned the statistics of the 1,773 unexplained accidents from 52 to 56. According to Leonard Stringfield, whom I knew, a great researcher and former Air Force intelligence officer, he was told by a reliable source at that time that the Air Force was losing about a plane a day to the UFOs, and that absolutely tallies with the Defense Department statistics, which published in my book for the first time, thanks to Richard Hall and his informant, Dr. Fontes in Brazil.
You know, I remember reading your book, Above Top Secret, long ago, and there was a photo of Winston Churchill in there, and a quote from him as saying, you know, ordering the Ministry of Defense, I guess, hey, what's the deal on the UFOs? But until I read this new book, I didn't understand the context. His comments were inspired by the D.C. overflights, or was it something else?
Yes, it was by the D.C. overflights, absolutely. What is all this stuff about flying saucers mean? You know, what's the truth? Let me have a report at your convenience. That's off the top of my head. It was something like that, and they came back, Prime Minister, don't worry. We've made an investigation in conjunction with the Americans. They were referring, of course, to the top-secret Flying Saucers Working Party, as it was called in Great Britain, wonderful title, which was established in 1950 for 1 year. They liaised with the Americans, and the object of the exercise, in my opinion, was the Americans were trying to get the Brits to discredit as many, especially the really good caliber sightings coming from pilots. I mean, we had sightings here in the very early 50s, prior to Washington, that there were sightings over Farnborough. Sort of major test pilots were seeing these things at Farnborough, the Royal Aircraft Establishment at Farnborough in Hampshire. And at low level, a craft came right over. I've described this in the book, came right over the airfield, seen by many officers, including these test pilots, on the ground. And this thing wasn't, it was at about, I don't know, no more than 1,000 feet, something like that. And it was metallic. It was making crackling sounds. There was a smell of ozone. There was a humming sound, and so on and so forth. And when the people from the Flying Saucers Working Party came to investigate, they took details very seriously and everything. And officially, the report was that the pilots had mistaken just conventional aircraft. So they were discredited. They were absolutely livid when they found out later on, when the British government released some of these reports about the British flying saucers.
Wasn't there something involving Lord Mountbatten? He had an interest in the phenomena. Maybe something landing at his home.
Absolutely, yes. This was in the mid 1950s. I think it was around 1955, 56, when, according to one of his staff, a craft came down and a sort of section lowered from it, and a humanoid was seen. And this witness was actually sort of knocked off his bicycle in shock. It was in snow at that time, and he was encouraged to tell his boss, Lord Mountbatten, who came out to the site with him and saw the tracks of the bicycle, where it had come down and everything. And Mountbatten believed that story. It's just one of many such stories. And I think certainly that inspired his interest, though I'm quite sure, according to my information, Mountbatten had a sighting in the Pacific Ocean during World War II.
I remember, and maybe it's from this book, maybe it's from an earlier book, that there was some suspicion that Mountbatten may have been a source for Dorothy Kilgallen, the American journalist who was pursuing the UFO mystery.
I wouldn't be at all surprised. I don't know for sure, but I think it's quite likely.
While we're on the subject of British UFO incidents and famous cases, the Rendlesham Forest case. I don't know if you heard earlier today in this program, I mentioned that Jacques Vallée had been in town here with the Remote Viewers Association, and I'd read something from Dr. Vallée about Rendlesham. He said that he was suspicious about that case because he believes that radar operators at this military base near where this incident had occurred had been told a couple of days beforehand, hey, keep an eye on the sea or what's going to come from the sea, his suspicion being that it may have been a manufactured incident. What's your take?
Well, I don't know is the answer to that. I mean, there may be some truth in that. What I can tell you is that about 10 days prior to the craft coming down, because Roswell... The Rendlesham Forest case, which involved the twin U.S. Air Force bases of Bentwaters and Woodbridge, took place starting on sort of Christmas night, 25, 26, 27, 20. It was going on for several nights. And whatever it was, this thing came right down so low that the U.S. Air Force security policemen actually were able to touch it at one stage with their feet. They were following it around the forest. I mean, it's an incredible case. And Nick Pope, who headed the UFO department in the Ministry of Defense from 1991 to 1994, he's absolutely convinced that this was from somewhere else. And at one stage, unofficially, at one stage, this craft, or one of the craft, was beaming down lights at the nuclear weapons storage area at these U.S. Air Force bases. And there were more nuclear weapons stored in Suffolk, in Great Britain, than anywhere else in Europe at that time, in December of 1980. But I'd also like to add, George, that on the 15th of December, this is 10 days prior to Woodbridge Bent Waters, an identical craft was seen right over my area. I saw it myself, not for long, unfortunately, and it was one of those rare occasions when I didn't have a camera with me or a movie camera. But I did see this brilliant point of light in the sky, and I wondered what on earth it was. It didn't seem like an aircraft. It was completely cloudless sky. But to cut a long story short, the next day I was told by a journalist that many people had seen for an hour and a quarter at least an object in the sky, and they were with binoculars. It was an elongated sort of triangular thing. Frequently, sections would come away from it and then regroup, and it would dart around the sky and then stay in one position for many minutes. And I'm sure that's the identical description of the craft that was seen in Bentwaters Woodbridge 10 days later. So I don't know about that story from Valet, but I can add that part to it. And video film was actually taken of that craft as well. Unfortunately, video was in its infancy in 1980. So the zoom range was very restricted. So there's not, you can't really see that much apart from a brilliant point of light.
But Tim, you're killing me. You had a UFO sighting?
Oh, sure. And as I say, when I got home, actually, I mean, because I've got, you know, cameras, zoom lenses, movie, the whole lot, telescope. Of course, that very minute, the thing decided to disappear. I swear they knew I was coming.
You're killing me. I mean, as long as I've been in this field, I've never seen anything remotely like a UFO, and I'm jealous, man.
Well, if only I had, you know, binoculars and everything else with me, then we would have got some. I could have got some great pictures, possibly.
Back to the Rendlesham Forest thing for just a moment. You know, I have great respect for Dr. Valet, and suspect that maybe he knows a little something there. But if this were, in fact, a manufactured incident, a counterintelligence move or a debunking move, you know, it was done at a top-secret military base. It was never meant to be made public, and it took a heck of a lot of effort to get any of the details out into the public arena. So it's hard to figure out what they would have been doing.
Charles Holt, who was the deputy base commander of both the twin Air Force bases at that time, and interestingly, he lives in Woodbridge, Virginia, which I find amusing. And he was absolutely livid, and I discussed this with him in person. He said, you know, this is your government's business. It didn't happen on our territory. It happened in Rendlesham Forest, which is just outside the Twin Air Force bases. You know, it's your problem. And he never got any kind of response from the Ministry of Defense at all about it. So you would have thought, if that was a counterintelligence exercise, as Valley suggests, you would think that the deputy base commander at least should have been informed of the event.
Absolutely. Tim Good, stick around. We've got another half an hour of conversation with Tim, and then later on we'll be opening it up to your questions. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. I'm talking with author Timothy Good, who has written this new book, blockbuster book, Need to Know. Tim, a lot of you in the audience may not know that Tim played an important role, a critical role, in one of the most controversial UFO subjects of modern times, and that's the MJ-12 controversy, the MJ-12 documents. He was one of the first to see these documents. The controversy has erupted again, if you've seen the latest edition of the MUFON Journal. And when we come back after this short break, I'm going to ask Tim about his role in this and where he falls in terms of the ongoing controversy between Brad Sparks and Stanton Friedman. So stick around. We'll be right back. with Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with British author Tim Good, whose new book, Need to Know, fascinating new insight into the worldwide UFO cover-up. Tim, you know, I'm a journalist. I'm not a philosopher. I can't even begin to try to figure out what is in the minds of these aliens, where they're from, why they're here. But there are some things that, as a journalist, I can follow, and that's the paper trail. There are, as you know better than anyone, perhaps, there's a solid paper trail, government documents, secret reports, secret statements and memos from our military and our government, your military and your government. These are documents that were never meant to be seen by the public, which describe the military's true take on UFOs and this mystery. You include a lot of these documents in this book, Need to Know, including this Nathan Twining memo, September of 1947, in which he basically says these UFOs are real, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, there's nothing spectacular about that, but, I mean, that's official. You know, the phenomenon is real and not something visionary or fictitious. That's what Twining said, and that is the official military position, and I'm surprised that more people don't cite that. I mean, that goes back to September of 1947.
What are there in your research? What are the most telling, provable, genuine documents from the inside that indicate what's really going on?
Oh my goodness, I wouldn't know where to start, George. I mean, there's so many. One of the things that's published for the first time in my book is a British report, which was only released by the Ministry of Defence last year. And this relates to sightings in March of 1993 in the Midlands, the central part of the United Kingdom. And there were two Royal Air Force bases at RAF Shawbury and RAF Cosford, which were penetrated by unknown objects, and these were the very large triangular type. And I've got two pages of this report, which is dated April of 1993, and it says that some of the reports state that the object was moving at a very high speed, while some say it was hovering or moving very slowly. Many of the reports refer to the object being very large, flying low, and making a low humming sound. My staff have spoken to a number of the military and police witnesses, many of whom commented that the object was unlike anything they had ever seen before. And the meteorological officer at RAF Shawbury reported seeing the object projecting a narrow beam of light at the ground at a height of 400 to 500 feet, and estimated the size of this object at somewhere between a C-30, it's a cargo plane, and a Boeing 747. When it passed over his head at an estimated 4,000 feet. And it continues, it concludes, in summary, there would seem to be some evidence on this occasion that an unidentified object or objects of unknown origin was operating over the UK. And so it goes on. So documents like that, I think, are fairly conclusive, in my opinion, at any rate.
You have one in this book, a 1949 Air Force intelligence report talking about multiple intrusions over military bases, nuclear bases, yes. Things of that sort. That's another telling one. Yes. We've seen memos as late as the 1960s where Air Force higher-ups put out these orders that indicate that UFOs are, quote, serious business.
Yes, I've got the actual, I've reproduced the actual order that was posted on all United States continental Air Force bases, saying just how seriously this subject, you know, saying that the press ridiculed it, but this must be rapidly identified as serious Air Force business, and it goes on and on. I mean, again, this is all official stuff from your government, acknowledging that we're dealing with a reality here, and I'm surprised that the press don't pick up on this more often. But let me say, talking about the press, George, I think listeners should know that, if they don't know already, that there was a big article in the Post, Washington Post, Sunday 21st, yesterday, that is my time, And I'd like to know whether it's actually in the newspaper itself or just online. But there's a, for the first time, I think, in the Post in recent years, there's a serious article by Joe Heim, Washington Post staff writer. It's called In the Orbit of UFO Enthusiasts. It's been posted on the net. I get it via Google Alert.
Yeah, I've read it. Yep.
You read it. It talks about Bob Swiatek and a lot of serious researchers, and there's not much of an element of ridicule about it, and I'm very impressed by this. I have sort of posted a comment to Joe Heim, but I haven't heard anything back yet. You know, but
we have these this paper trail. It's very telling. It's very serious, and it sort of paints it in black and white that there really is something going on, and our military has known about it for a long time. But one reason that the press people, reporters may have trouble pursuing this is because there are other documents that pop up from time to time that whose provenance is less solid. I mean,
exactly.
The MJ-12 document.
You wanted to ask me about MJ-12.
I do. The reason it's timely now, if I don't know if you've seen the current issue of the MUFON Journal, but you were there in Denver when Brad Sparks got up and delivered this scathing report about the MJ-12 documents and where they came from. His basic theory is that Stan Friedman, Bill Moore, Jamie Chandray were working on the Roswell story, doing all this research. At the same time, the information was being routed to the Air Force through Bill Moore, this agent named, intelligence officer named Rick Doty, and that he, in fact, was feeding it back to them in the form of these documents. He would take their information and create this. Where do you come down on this?
Well, first of all, let me say that, I, as you know, I was the first to publish the Majestic 12 documents.
Right.
I was amused to see Brad Sparks' comment that I received my copy from Rick Doty. That's absolute. So it makes me wonder, you know, how much of the rest of his article is pure invention. That is not the case. I have never released the name of the person I did obtain my documents from. But it certainly wasn't Rick Doty. I've never even met him. I've never communicated with him. I've tried to meet him, but he's not interested. But as I have said in most of my books subsequent to Above Top Secret, I believe the documents are fraudulent, but that there was a Majestic 12 document, and that the whole purpose of the exercise, the people who fabricated the document, was to smoke out the real MJ-12, and they were successful in doing that because several people confirmed that there was a Majestic 12 or an MJ-12 or a Magic 12. Now, one of whom was Dr. Eric Walker, who was a British physicist and a Harvard graduate, and he was former executive secretary of the Research and Development Board, chairman of National Science Foundation's Committee for Engineering, and so on, and president of Penn State University. And this is in a recorded conversation with Bill Steinman in 1987, confirmed that he'd attended meetings at Wright-Patterson concerning the military recovery of flying saucers and occupants, and he confirmed the existence of MJ-12. So,
and would Sarbacher,
I beg your pardon?
Thinks, would Sarbacher, Robert Sarbacher, would he be on that short list of people who've confirmed it?
Yes. Not sort of directly, but certainly indirectly, and other people have confirmed that there was definitely a Magic 12 or an MJ-12. And I mentioned Andy Kistner, the former state representative for Las Cruces, who gave me a lot of information. He believes, and I've published it in the book, that the acronyms MAJIC and MJ-12 could have been formed from the Manhattan, short for Manhattan Engineering District, Joint Chiefs of Staff Integrated Command, Project Y of Division Z, Group 12. Now, I won't go into all that's all rather complex, but I was in touch with Sandia Laboratories historian Rebecca Ulrich for my research into all this, and she said she'd no records pertaining to anything like that, MG-12, Magic 12, or Majestic. But I think another possibility suggested by Dr. Wood, who of course is very much involved in the Majestic controversy, is that MAJIC was formed from military assessment of the Joint Intelligence Committee, and that sounds quite possible as well. But it remains clear to me that there was definitely an organization of that name.
Tell me this. You mentioned that, you know, you're not going to tell us who your source is, where you got the MJ-12 documents from. You know it wasn't from Rick Doty. Is it at all possible that your source had some contact with Rick Doty, that Doty might have fed the documents to he or her?
I'm sure it's possible.
Okay. So do you believe that there's an MJ-12 now? Or something like it?
By whatever name, yes, I do, definitely.
Do you have any kind of proof, or is it just a feeling that
I don't have any proof, no.
More of a feeling that there would have to be someone that would handle this stuff?
Absolutely, no question about it.
What's your take on Colonel Phil Corso?
I think he's on the level. Unfortunately, he didn't check the manuscript before it was published, so there are a number of errors, and things have been slipped in by his co-author, are not quite accurate. But I think essentially, yes, he was absolutely on the level. Moreover, people have tried to tell me that Corso had nothing to do with the National Security Council. This I've been able to disprove because I have the actual military papers which confirm that although he wasn't on the National Security Council itself, and maybe that was just part of the manuscript he didn't check in his book, he served on the intelligence staff of the National Security Council's Operation Coordinations Board, later known as the Special Group 5412, then Special Group 5412/2, which planned, coordinated, approved, and evaluated the most sensitive covert paramilitary and clandestine operations ever mounted by a United States government. So that's what Corso was doing. Top secret work as an intelligence officer at the National Council, but he didn't actually stand on the National Council, the Security Council itself.
Right. And now, you know, one of the main criticisms of Corso, he had said that that technology, that materials from crashed or recovered saucers had been sort of filtered out to industry, to national labs and things of that sort.
In the early 60s.
And of course, the critics have said, "Nah, that's a bunch of baloney. We developed this stuff on our own. There's a paper trail to show where fiber optics and things like that came from."
Absolutely right. Well, Corso's take on that was he told a friend of mine who is very well informed. He told that person, scientist, that was not what his position was, that they actually farmed this stuff out to the American industrial corporations at a time when people were starting to work on this. So it wasn't as described in the book. So the critics are absolutely right, but Corso himself was very upset that that's the way it came across in the book, and it's not what he maintained.
You know, you and I, we started our conversation with talking about disclosure and how it might work and why it's unlikely. This topic came up while we were in Denver. You know, there are a lot of groups in the UFO field who are pushing for congressional hearings as if that would somehow be a revelation and it would be, you know, a smooth sailing after that. What's your take on congressional hearings? Possible, likely, unlikely, unproductive?
Listen, I've been involved for decades, periodically assisting congressmen, a number of your congressmen, in inquiries with the object of getting closed hearings. Each one of them has been stopped or has otherwise sort of ground to a halt, occasionally in suspicious circumstances. And I'm not going to go much further than that, except to say that Congress is sewn up. And there are not enough people with enough guts to pursue it because they will be discouraged, to put it that way.
They will be
discouraged from having anything like closed hearings with the object of opening up information.
I think I've spoken to some of the same people that you've spoken to. I know that there is interest among some elected members of Congress in this topic, but it's got to be on a very quiet level. And you know, just from a pure political standpoint, they'd be crucified for showing an interest in a topic that so many people think is goofy. The other thing I worry about is, and maybe you can comment on it as well, is the existence of highly vocal UFO groups who would raise hell if they were left out of any congressional hearing. And these are groups who have very controversial beliefs that are not even shared by most of the people in the UFO field, perhaps created specifically for the purpose of deterring congressional hearings.
Yeah. Quite likely. I go along with you.
Tell me about the book now. Is it available here in the States now?
It was published on Friday, George. The 18th, anyway. When was the 18th? Was that Thursday, Friday? And it should be in the shops. I haven't had any reports yet otherwise, but it's overdue by quite a number of months. So I know people have been frustrated in trying to get it. And, of course, you can get it on Amazon for a cheaper price and so forth. But it should be in the bookshops. And if there's any problem, you can put people in touch with me.
Okay. Well, Need to Know, UFOs, the Military, and Intelligence by Tim Good. That's the book. Any chance you're going to do a book tour? You coming over here to speak?
I wish, but I can't afford it, believe it or not. Unfortunately, I'd love to do that. And I'm cooperating with my publisher as best I can in promoting the book. But I shall certainly be over in the States next year.
You're working on another book already, or can you tell us?
No, I'm still recovering from this one, clearing the debris, all the research material.
And is your publisher, I know this is a different publisher for you this time?
It is, yes. Pegasus Books of New York. And on my website there are details of how to contact them should any difficulties arise with obtaining books. And I can also send, if anyone wants me to send them the press release, I'd be glad to do that.
There's one other question.
I'd be glad to give any interviews in people's local towns or radio stations or whatever.
All right, there it is, folks. We're going to open this up to your questions for Tim Good in a minute. I've got time for one more, unrelated to the UFO cover-up stuff that we're discussing in your book, Need to Know. It's about Skinwalker Ranch, which is, of course, is something that I've written about, the Utah Ranch. And while we're researching the working on the book about the strange goings-on there, we come across your reference to a similar ranch in Colorado. I know it's been a while since you looked at this stuff. Can you remember enough details to know whether the comparison is valid?
I think very valid indeed. This I wrote in my book, I believe it was Alien Contact, the one in the States, and they called it Alien Liaison over here. I had a chapter on that. I think it was called Colorado Breakthrough, or just Breakthrough, I forget which. But I found that very interesting, particularly since there was a U.S. Air Force officer involved, and it wasn't that far from the U.S. Air Force base, and these Bigfoot sightings, all manner of strange things, and UFO sightings, and actual contacts with humanoid type occupants, and I find that a very, very compelling case. So there are parallels with the Skinwalker business.
Any possibility that was some sort of a disinformation campaign or psychological exercise, or do you have an opinion?
Yes, it may well have been a psychological exercise, George, but, the question is who's perpetrating it? I mean, the aliens aren't above sort of befuddling us, and are they?
No, they are not, and neither is our government. Tim Good, good chatting with you, but stick around. We're going to open up our phone lines, and listeners, I hope you got your A game on and you got some good questions for Tim. We'll be right back in a couple of minutes. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. We've got an hour to spend with British author Tim Good. He knows a heck of a lot about UFOs and government conspiracies and cover-ups. And, we started this evening by discussing the passion that Coast to Coast listeners have for the show. Well, show me how much you care about it. Put your thinking caps on. Ask some good questions of Tim. Because he's here and he's here for you. We're going to go to the wild card line, Jim in Pennsylvania. Jim, what's on your mind?
Yeah, George, good evening. Listen,
good evening.
I would like to revisit your question to your guest in regards to our being able to shoot down technically advanced, or I should say technologically advanced craft. And I have a theory on this, and I'd like to bring your guest's considerable expertise to bear on what I think is actually happening.
Okay.
I believe that we do not have the capability to shoot these craft out of the sky, and that what's happening is that we're more or less being swatted aside like flies or mosquitoes. And this is why we're having all of these crashes and such like that. And what's happened is that ever since that we developed, since we entered the very beginnings of our technological age, that we somehow attracted the attention of various different species. And they discovered that we have some kind of resource that they want, and I believe that there's a competition going on amongst different species, and they're shooting each other out of the sky.
Jim?
Yes?
I agree with every word.
Good.
Absolutely spot on.
So, Tim, you don't believe that we have the technological capability of shooting any of them down?
I don't think so. I don't think so. You know, they have the ability to travel either through time or another dimension or have broken the light barrier. If they're going to share that technology with us, they certainly would have shared a lot more than they already have. I don't think that we're ready for it, and I think they have the intelligence to recognize that.
However, Jim, I do think we have acquired some technology which is being put to use in the weapons field to deal with
that.
That
I agree with,
problems.
Yes. Yeah, I definitely do agree that there is some technology that we have acquired.
And have you considered that we might be getting help from some species who are concerned? Because, as I said in my last book, I mean, unfortunately, which wasn't published in the States, I sent George a copy, Unearthly Disclosure. The whole theme of the book was that there is a conflict on this Earth between, not just between us and some species, but between the species, the alien species themselves. And this
I completely agree with you 100%.
And I've got a lot of evidence for that from reliable people who've actually witnessed various incidents of that nature in a number of countries. So I think that is another part of the problem. But I agree with you. Everything else you said, absolutely. We haven't got a chance in heaven of knocking out some of these craft. They just swat us down like mosquitoes, as you say, if needs be, and they have done so on hundreds of occasions.
Jim, thank you very much for a good point and a good comment. We're going to the east of the Rockies line. Brian in New York is up mighty early this morning, or mighty late, I should say. Brian, what do you got?
Yeah, I had a question basically about if these people are as advanced as they are, my first idea would be that to get this far out into space and that technologically advanced, they'd probably have to be able to work together and, you know, not fighting amongst themselves. But what I don't understand is why our governments of the world, seeing this technology, haven't gotten together for, A, either to see, they've seen the advances that can happen, and that, you know, pooling all of our resources, we could get to that level and, you know, cure cancers and feed everybody. Or B, if they're hostile, you know, wouldn't we have a much better chance pulling our government together to fight them if they are this advanced? And just the idea that they're out there is just such a phenomenal idea that, you know, that would, I would think, precede any concerns over religious, you know, consequences. Let them get it over with.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you up to a point, Brian, certainly. I believe that there has been collaboration between governments, certainly. For example, President Gorbachev confirmed that at the Geneva summit in 1985, he and President Reagan agreed that the Soviet Union and the United States would collaborate in the event of an extraterrestrial attack. That is officially confirmed, that statement. So there was collaboration. It doesn't look very good at the moment, collaboration with with Russia, but certainly there has been collaboration. This is confirmed by a lot of scientists, and it's not generally known. I mean, this is officially now confirmed that in 1977, President Andropov of the Soviet Union set up the top secret, it was called Institute 22, that was the code name, for a top secret UFO research project that involved 4 million military personnel, as well as probably a million or so civil servants. It was classified, highly classified. It lasted at least 10 years, and this has been confirmed by many military and scientific personnel. And the details of that are in my book. And I think that there has to be collaboration between the major powers, certainly the nuclear powers, on this subject. But at the same time, there's always, the sort of basic nature of humanity, competitive politics, wanting to get the upper hand and to take advantage of other countries on this planet.
Just to add about Institute 22, I'm more than familiar with
Absolutely.
That.
You did great work, George. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's okay.
A lot of your research is actually mentioned in my book, as you will, I hope, have noted.
Indeed, yeah. We were the ones that were able to dig up the first documents about Institute 22 back in 1993,
yes.
And you're absolutely right. There was an incident that was mentioned, and also it mentioned in your book about and I'm sorry to interrupt you, Brian, but it's an incident that happened at a Ukrainian military ICBM base where UFOs hovered over the base and basically disabled the missiles. And it was almost like sending a message that these may be your most powerful weapon systems, but they don't mean squat to us.
Absolutely.
Brian, thank you for your question. We're going to go to our first-time caller, Terry, in Nebraska. Terry, what's going on?
Good morning, gentlemen. I'd like to tell you, first of all, I've seen 5 craft in my lifetime that are pretty much unexplainable, with the exception of 2. I've seen a pair of the 2 triangles, black triangles, and they were very close. Now, I'm going to give you a theory, and then I'll take your comments on the radio. Say, for example, the U.S. government or another government in the world has either been given or captured the technology to create these on their own. They put them over the roadways in their own country, so they're very visible, many times, many places. They now have the perfect spy machine to go anywhere they want to go in the world, and nobody's going to point the finger at anybody. Thank you, and I'm curious to hear what you have to say. Thank you.
I'll tell you what, thank you, Terry, for the question. Tim, if you wouldn't mind, we need to take another break right here. Think about that, and when we come back, I'll give you a chance to answer it.
Okay.
All right. So this is I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Stick around. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. We're talking with Timothy Good, author of Need to Know. Just had a question from Terry in Nebraska. You want to tackle it, Tim?
Now, it's very interesting what Terry is saying, that, you know, is it possible some of these triangular, he claims to have seen 5 craft, including some he can't explain, such as black triangles up close. I mean, I'd like to hear more about that. But before we hear back from him, let me say, I think in theory, it's quite possible that some of these craft are indeed American Black Project top secret aircraft or spacecraft. It becomes a very murky area. We're dealing with things that we're not supposed to know about. But let me quote from earlier on. I mentioned this this extraordinary document, which was only released by Britain's Ministry of Defence last year, which refers to flying triangles which penetrated not just British airspace but 2 Royal Air Force bases. And let me just read the last paragraph of this previously secret document. In summary, there would seem to be some evidence on this occasion that an unidentified object or objects of unknown origin was operating over the UK. Given recent speculation about Aurora by both media and members of Parliament, it is surprising that so far this has not been taken up by the press or again by members of Parliament. If there has been some activity of U.S. origin which is known to a limited circle in the Ministry of Defence and is not being acknowledged, it is difficult to investigate further. So I think that says it all, really. There is consideration then, and that's 1993, quite a long time ago, about penetration by triangular objects. And I'd like to hear more about what you saw, Terry.
Terry's gone. He's gone. Listening on the phone. But I'll just add this, Tim. I don't know if you're aware, if you're familiar with what this study that NIDS has done, the National Institute for Discovery Science, which was based in here in Las Vegas and is now inactive. But they've taken a pretty hard look at the black triangle sightings. Yep. And what Terry was saying is pretty accurate. These things have been seen over major cities, over highways. As if whoever is flying them doesn't really care if they're seen by a lot of people.
That's right, and it's possible. I keep an open mind that some of these are indeed American top secret aircraft and spacecraft. You know that Ben Rich, who was one of the heads of the famous Skunk Works, Lockheed, producing the U-2 and Stealth and so forth, has gone on the record, and I know one of the people who this was told to, and I've written it in the book. I mean, Rich said, you know, we have the technology to go to the stars. And he was very serious about it. He said, we're just lacking a few equations. And this was about 12 years ago. He said, we're just lacking a few equations, but we have the technology.
Boy, oh boy. We're going to go now west of the Rockies, Ryan in Vancouver. Ryan?
Hi, how's it going?
Good morning.
I'll just make it brief. I got 2 questions, for Nick. How's it going? Did you ever, by any chance, ever work with Jalen Hynek or Nick Pope? And that's kind of weird because you're speaking of Kelso, Washington. I just live south of there in Vancouver, so it's kind of weird because my grandpa was out here, and he told me about that before he died. But, yeah, I just want to know, and I'll take my answers off the air. I appreciate it.
Ron, can you tell me who the first person you mentioned?
It said Hynek.
Yeah, Dr. Jalen Hynek. I worked for Project Blue Book from 47 to 69. I'm only 23, but I'm kind of I live in the past, so I'm old-fashioned.
Yeah. I met Alan Hynek. I never worked with him. Nick Pope is a very good friend. I don't work for the government, for any government. I'm completely independent reporter, if you like. But I will tell you something about Alan Hynek, and it's come out in the book, in my new book for the first time, and that is I have very reliable information that in addition to being consultant to the United States Air Force from the 1940s, responsible for debunking nearly all UFO reports, he was also a consultant to the CIA's Office of Scientific Intelligence. All right? And that is in my new book, Need to Know.
Well, take it further. The significance of that being what? That you think he was being directed by CIA to do the debunking?
Obviously.
Yeah. Well, it's entirely possible. But he did change his mind later in life.
Yes, he certainly did. He did some very good work. I mean, the Hynek UFO report has got some terrific stuff in it. I've cited it in my book. I think that started off with the famous Dexter Michigan things in 1965, you know, when he became known as Old Swamp Gas for explaining away the sightings at the girls' college, you know, as possibly due to swamp gas. And, you know, the Air Force got so much flack out of that that they had to change their tune, and Hynek became much more conciliatory and, of course, started writing books and formed the Center for UFO Studies.
Okay, Brian, thank you for the question. We're going to go now to our wild card one line, Dale in Montana. Dale, what's on your mind?
Well, hello there. I just have a couple of questions here. I was just asking Tim, have you ever heard about a crash in Aztec, New Mexico?
I've written a whole chapter on it, Dale.
Oh,
in my new book.
Okay, I've got a book from William Bill Steinman.
I've got the one, too. It's very, very good.
Yes, and also, too, on the Four Corners up there, by friends and relatives that worked in the Air Force in the 40s, they said they were experimenting with radar equipment in the Four Corners.
Absolutely, and, absolutely. I've got all the technical details about that particular radar site. And basically, I mean, the Aztec case of I think it was March of 1948 was actually far more important than Roswell. There was a craft which was in almost perfect condition.
Yes, I have a date of 7/7/48.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was about 100 feet in diameter, and you know, there was tons of scientific data extracted from that retrieval. Much more important than Roswell.
Yeah, I'm just really curious because I've never heard of anybody talking about the radar and around the Four Corners and all the spacecraft that have been falling out of the sky because of the radar.
Yeah.
And the military had got so many of them, they started burying them and dumping them in old mine shafts around in the Four Corners area.
Yeah, right. Scott Ramsey has done a great deal of work on that, as has my friend John Andy Kistner. And I think I've got the details here from them, like the 767th Aircraft Control and Warning System radar unit was based up that traced the craft. And there were other radar sites probably the most powerful radar sets in the world at that time, requiring very elaborate safety precautions. So,
you know, Tim, there are those who theorize that the radar had something to do with bringing down some of these craft.
Interfering the controlling mechanism of the craft. I think that's quite possible. I think it's quite possible.
Hey, Dale, thank you very much. We're going to go to Pete in one of my favorite cities in the world, Nashville. Pete, what's on your mind?
Hi, George. Good evening.
Good evening.
I was wondering how long all this stuff's going to keep going on before somebody can actually get our government or UFO land to, I guess, inform everybody. It seems like we're the only ones in the dark. Our government's kind of toss it back and forth.
Yeah.
Like Area 51. Recently, you know, when they was hunting for Stephen Fawcett, you know, they found like 6 crashed aircraft. And about a year ago, Art Bell had an interview with somebody called in and was doing a flyover over Area 51. And it was a crazy call, and he started reporting how they were being shot at and everything. And Art was trying to advise the guy not to go in there. Then all of a sudden he disappeared, and like this aircraft, all these aircraft they found out in the desert there, one of them could be his. How long is all this just going to keep going on before somebody let something out?
I don't know. I'd like to say two things, though, Pete. First of all, when we talk about governments covering up, we're talking about a fraction of people in governments who actually know what's going on. Believe me, it is such a sensitive matter that only those with need to know will find out something about it. And even then, it's all compartmented. So you're talking about, if you like, an inner government or a cabal. It's nothing less than that, in my opinion. And secondly, about I think it was about 5 years ago, I asked a friend of mine in Washington how long it's going to be. I mean, he knows that I've been studying this subject since 1955, actually. And I said, you know, how long is it going to be before this sort of stuff's going to come out? And he just said two words to me, laughing. He said, "Stay healthy." So, you know, that was 5 years ago, and I think it's been pointed out to me on several occasions. It has to be gradual, and even then, are we going to get the full truth? I very much doubt it. Do the aliens want us to know what they're doing here? Do you really think so? I think in some cases, absolutely, some of them might. We have allies, put it that way. There are people out there who look compassionately at the human race, but there are others who are more interested in what their own needs. I'm quite sure of that.
You know, Tim, that there are those who believe, and some indications, that perhaps the technology, the secrets, have been taken out of government, out of the purview, put into private hands as a further buffer between the truth and us being ever finding it out. What do you take on that?
I think it's more than likely, George, quite frankly. There's got to be some sort of corporate and individual sponsors involved in all this that are anxious to protect the status quo.
All right. Well, Pete in Nashville, thanks for that call. Good calls. Good calls tonight, Coast to Coast AM listeners. I'm George Knapp. We'll be back in a moment with more of Tim Good and more of Coast to Coast AM. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for sticking with us. It's been a fascinating couple of hours with Tim Good, the author of the new book, Need to Know, UFOs, the Military, and Intelligence. And Coast to Coast listeners, you're coming through with some mighty fine questions this morning. We're going to go now to our wild card line, Larry in Montana. Larry, you're on Coast to Coast AM.
Hello, how are you? Good evening.
Okay.
Good morning, I'm sorry. I had a question about Dr. Brown's sphere that was found. It's a quartz crystal sphere that was found in 1970 off of the coast of Bimini. And I feel that it is the key to cheap free energy and how the pyramids were built. And I wondered if you or your guest knew anything about the sphere and where it might be located today, and how come that the only object that was not from this world, because of its characteristics and because of its 10,000ths of an inch specifications, couldn't be built in 1970 with our greatest technology. And I will take the answer off the air. And I want to tell you that I really appreciate the integrity and the focus that y'all are showing in the show.
Well, thanks, Larry. You've stumped me. I don't know anything about this sphere. Tim, does that ring a bell with you?
It's out of my sphere, too, George. I have the faintest idea about this thing at all.
Larry, we're sorry we can't answer that, but maybe that's something we're going to have to look into and maybe delve into it on a future show. We're going to go to our first-time caller line, Ed in Wisconsin. You're up kind of early this morning, Ed. You're on Coast to Coast AM.
Thank you. In your opinion, is it possible that some kind of understanding has been reached between officers in the United States government and one or more extraterrestrial powers?
Yes.
Understanding that might have to be disclosed if there were a congressional investigation.
Yes, to both. That's my opinion.
And you don't care to elaborate, or?
Well, I mean, he's right. There has indeed been some kind of understanding, obviously established since we are, that there is a liaison program. Of that, I know to be a fact. There is a liaison program involving a few military and scientific intelligence personnel who liaise with a certain group of ETs. And it's been going on for quite a long time. I don't know a great... Well, I have actually published quite a bit. I've gained some information that there are bases on our planet, many of them, and that some of them have been here for a very long time. In fact, one of the theories in my book that I sort of lean towards is that some aliens have been on this planet for longer than we have. And if there were to be any closed hearings, this possibly might be disclosed, but Congress is not really in any kind of control of the situation, whatever information is given to them.
Thanks for that call, Ed. Tim, tell me this. Do you, I can't remember if it's in this book or a previous book, the discussion about Eisenhower meeting face-to-face with these guys at an Air Force base in Southern California?
I've elaborated on that. Due to a little, you know, I've got a few more names of individuals involved in that case. This is February 1954 at Edwards Air Force Base when Eisenhower allegedly, there was an arranged meeting. Several craft actually landed at Edwards Air Force Base and Eisenhower was there with some aides and names are mentioned. And apparently... One of the things that they did was to demonstrate their superior technology by making themselves invisible or their craft, which caused Eisenhower considerable embarrassment. And he said, hey, guys, I don't think we're ready for all this. These particular aliens were very human appearing, apart from their remarkable abilities.
You know, it's always occurred to me that wouldn't happen now. I mean, the Secret Service wouldn't allow the president to go meet face to face with some potentially dangerous adversaries, would he? Would they?
I don't know. I honestly don't know, George. But I do think that meeting did actually take place. There is certainly some evidence for it, and a lot of named people were involved in that, both military and from the civilian world, like Archbishop McIntyre of Los Angeles.
Okay, we're going to go back to the phones right now. Sonny in Arkansas, you're on Coast to Coast AM.
Great show tonight. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Tim.
Yeah.
We met briefly in Eureka Springs last year.
Oh, good. I hope you're coming next April.
Great. Well, that was going to be one of my questions. I'm glad you had the best presentation there, I thought.
Thank you very much indeed.
I'm wondering, you were talking about the Secret Service and the President a minute ago. Do you think that that President Truman was hustled out of the White House in 1952? Or into the bunkers underneath it?
I don't know. I don't know anything about that. I'm sorry.
I wondered if anybody had ever heard anything about that.
I'm
sure he would have been.
I honestly don't know.
That'd be an interesting subject for a FOIA request, wouldn't it? If there had been any incident like that, whether or not those files had been cleaned out or not.
Correct.
That's an interesting thought. Anything else, Sonny?
No, that's it.
All right. Thank you for the call. We're going to take our last break, and then we'll be back with more questions for Tim Good before we call it an evening here. So stick around. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. It's been a lot of fun speaking with Tim Good, author of the new book, Need to Know. You've been asking some great questions. We got a couple of minutes left and a couple of more callers on the line. We're going to go to Bogey in Brentwood, California on the wild card line. Bogey, good morning.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. Amazing show. I'll be reading off a piece of paper. Seem to take it for granted that we're being visited, and I have no problem with that. But even with our science, we know that the energy required to achieve any kind of interstellar travel or bending of the space and time, is it really possible for living beings or beings that are perishable, which have a limited amount of lifespan, for them to travel here? Or would we be looking at something that they call the Van Neumann probes, which is a sort of self-replicating artificial intelligence that time doesn't really matter for it, and they could travel with this of our shuttle, and they'll still get to the end of the galaxy, even in billions of years. But they don't. There is no life involved in that. Could you comment on something?
Bogey, the only thing I can comment on is that aliens, if we're to believe their communications with us, and thousands of people, I believe, have had communication contacts with alien beings, they say that their technology is so advanced that they can manipulate space and time, or, as Einstein called it, space-time, since both are inextricably linked. And there's a lovely story I've got in my last book, Unearthly Disclosure, of Enrique Castillo, South American contactee who was taken on board a craft, and he was puzzling. He said, "You come from where?" And it was some distant part of the galaxy. And he said, "When did you leave?" And they said, "Oh, we just left." So I think it's possible that some of them at least have developed virtually instantaneous travel whereby they can fold time and space. So there's no linear travel as such. You know, they don't use rockets or propellers or anything comparable to what we have. Or at least, you know, it's possible we are developing it. I'm sure of that.
Yeah, Bogey, very reasonable questions and very understandable questions. You look at some of the cutting-edge research taking place now in quantum theory and things of that sort, and I think we're reaching the point where we realize that this kind of travel, timeless travel in essence, is in fact possible. I remember, and you do too, Tim, Bob Lazar, when he talked about the craft out there, he talked about folding space and time. I know a lot of people don't give him much credibility, but the system that he described is now considered to be feasible.
Yeah.
Anyway, Bogey, thank you for that call. We're going to go to Dan in Temecula. What's on your mind, Dan?
Yeah, Mr. Good. I was curious about something. I read a book several years ago. It's been quite a few years ago. Referenced an author by the name of George Adamski.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if you have any exposure to any of his writings and what your opinion would be on his works, if you've had or had read.
Glad you raised that question, Dan. First of all, I co-authored a book on George Adamski. There are no copies available. There may be something on the internet. Go to my website, which is timothygood.co.uk. That's timothygood.co.uk. And go to books, and you can see the book there. I studied Adamski's claims for many, many years, and I think that he was absolutely on the level about many of his claims, and he did ride on board the spaceships. And I've written in a number of books, including the latest one, Need to Know, that he indeed did have contact with extraterrestrials, and I've reproduced a frame from the last film that he took of UFOs in a suburb of Washington in 1965, which I was told at the Pentagon in 1998, when I was invited by the director of the Defense Airborne Reconnaissance Office, which at that time handled the unmanned spy planes, I was told that, in his opinion, that film was genuine. He couldn't see how it had been faked. I showed him various frames from it.
Okay. Thank you. Hey, Tim, here's a question I had. You know, I've had an ongoing interest in the animal mutilation cases, mostly cattle, but a lot of different kind of animals.
Yeah, me too.
Are they occurring in Europe at all?
Well, I read reports, George, but I'm skeptical of most of them. I have to say, not all, but most of them, I think, are not the real thing. They don't have the classic hallmarks. I think, in general, it is restricted to the Americas, South America, Central America, and North America, including Canada, of course.
And what's your guess on it? Is it some other intelligence doing a sampling project, yes, or is it us, or is it both?
I don't think it's us. I mean, this has been going on since the late 1950s, according to Colonel Corso. I don't think we have the technology. I mean, various people have tried to assure me that the Air Force is doing this, you know, and I had one of my sources say, "Oh, yes, it's the Air Force. It's done with helicopters." And I said, "Well, you know, how long does this operation take?" And they said 12.5 minutes. I mean, there you are. Usually it's done instantaneously, and there's no trace. And as you know perfectly well, there's no blood around. There's no way that if it was done by humans that it wouldn't be spotted.
And what do you think that they're looking for? Is it, you have any guesses?
Genetic material. I think definitely they need genetic material. Perhaps it's to do with the hybrid. I think there is a hybridization program. And if that's the case, the question is it for their benefit or for ours?
We got Dan in New York on the wild card line. Dan, what's up?
I'm there.
Hello? Yeah, hello. Good morning.
Am I on?
Yes, you are, Dan. Good morning. You're on Coast to Coast AM.
Oh, my goodness, that was fast. And I wanted to ask Timothy Good, what did you exactly meant about Philip Corso, about the back engineer technology? Because I have a powerful interest in the fact that we did reverse, that the government did, reverse engineer technology from the extraterrestrial crafts, because Philip Corso actually wasn't the only one that said it. There was a CIA informant, a CIA contractor, Don Phillips, part of the Disclosure Project. Stanton Friedman also mentioned the transistor. Mm-hmm. Or back to Don Phillips, he mentioned several devices, as opposed, of course, I mentioned about 14.
Okay.
But, the other guy mentioned, someone else, Kevin Randall mentioned fiber optics.
Yeah.
Okay, you can go ahead and speak.
Well, I think it's true that definitely that we have inherited some of these materials and have passed them into the corporate giants, if you like, since the 1960s.
Dan, does that answer your question?
Oh, I think it is.
I could go further. Can you be a bit more specific, Don, in your question?
Well, what I meant was it sounded almost a while back there when I listened to you about, it was about 10 to 4,
yeah,
about an hour ago. It sounded like that you were dismissing what Corso said.
On the contrary. Not at all. I only said that he was not happy with the way it appeared in the book. Don't forget, he didn't actually write the final draft of the book. He just he told a scientist friend of mine that it wasn't true, because people have come forward, the scientists who were working on these various things, like fiber optics, have come forward and said, well, hey, you know, I was working on that at that time. What Corso actually said to a scientist friend of mine was that when the various industries working on these projects, scientists and so forth, were working on something, we came forward with the material that was sort of kind of related to the project, which would advance their project. So,
well, kind of related, of course, as you know, isn't exact. So perhaps what the government did back engineer from the alien technology wasn't exactly what the government was working on to begin with. Do you agree on that?
That's quite possible, absolutely.
Yeah. Hey, Timothy, it's great to talk with you. God bless you. And, George, keep up the good work.
Thanks, Dan. You know, thank you. You know, earlier you had kind of had to gloss over this, but you mentioned something, and it's in your book about a so-called Z division. Could you explain what that is? And do you believe that that was sort of the repository for a study of all this material at some point?
I do indeed. In fact, the Z division was started. It was started by Robert Oppenheimer. He was one of the first. It was created in July 1945. And it was named after a guy called Gerald Zacharias, who was a physics professor at MIT. And he led the division until October, and then it was taken over by various people. But it was primarily to improve the ordnance design and sort of security of the first atomic bombs. It was explained to me by Sandia Laboratories historian. And it was organized into several groups or compartments, including Z-12, which was called the Manual Preparation Group. And they dealt, according to my information, a branch of the division was dealt with the subject, because all the people that were dealing with the above top secret UFO situation at that time were mostly in the nuclear physics area.
And so you think that this...
It evolved there. It started there at that time.
And do you think that these guys carried on the study of the UFO phenomena for some time, or may have been responsible for analyzing?
It all started, I think, everything was humming and buzzing in New Mexico in 1945, following the first explosion of the atomic bomb there, and then, of course, other developments in the nuclear field, and this is what got the UFOs excited, and all the original above top secret research was centered in Los Alamos and elsewhere in White Sands and elsewhere in New Mexico.
You know, there's one other thing in your book that I wanted to talk about while we've got just a minute or so left. It's it's a one-line thing that, where you talked about the discussion of aliens being responsible for warming the water of our oceans as one of the types of threats.
This is what I was told by one of my contacts. I have a whole chapter in my previous book, but I reiterated some of it in Need to Know. I've been told that aliens have long established bases here and that various elements of the military and intelligence community, scientific intelligence community, are liaising with some of these people. And our people were very concerned that the alien activity in some of the Earth's oceans, such as the Pacific Ocean, was contributing toward a warming of the waters, as it was put to me, and this was a cause for grave concern. Also, there was concern, I was told, about the manipulation of tectonic plates by the aliens. For what purpose, I don't know, but this was a cause of grave concern to those few who are liaising with the aliens.
Wouldn't that be something if aliens were responsible for the phenomena that we see as global warming?
It puts a new angle on things, doesn't it? I think that the activity of the sun is being overlooked, actually, quite seriously. I think the sun, there are going to be changes on our sun, which probably are also contributing towards. I mean, you know, I believe the Martian ice caps are melting. I've read that, you know, and I don't think human beings have got anything to do with that.
We got about 30 seconds, Tim. You and I started this conversation talking about, you know, what does it all mean? Do you have any advice for regular people? I mean, you know, we're all interested in this topic, but it doesn't seem to make much difference in our everyday life. You know?
It's completely irrelevant to the majority of people. But I think as time goes by and we appreciate these things, and it will become very, very relevant indeed. As one person in a certain government told me, it is the most important subject facing this planet.
Tim Good.
I don't know all the reasons for that, but I certainly know some of them. And if people in high places are saying that, then we're going to be paying attention to it.
Timothy Good, author of Need to Know, thank you. This book is now available on Amazon.com. If you're interested, it probably should be in your local bookstore soon. It's been a fascinating couple of hours. Thanks for all the great calls, everyone. Thanks to John Lear and, of course, to the Coast to Coast team. I'm George Knapp, and I'll see you next month, everyone.